Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that's in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, well, you come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave here with Capital K, and we are here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time around, we go to the infrastructure level. We get down deep, deep in the trenches, deep in what it means to bring yield and democratize it to users and financialize that risk that is already there. We have on Chunda from Nucleus to break down what he has built. We had him on before previously with Ion, and this is kind of, you know, what we were saying before, an evolution of what he has built. Kit, what are your thoughts on this one?
Man, I think users just going to strap in. I don't want to reserve from getting the pen and paper, but just try to listen to this one, because conceptually, once you get it, everything gels.
Yeah, I just say, like, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with this one. Yeah, and, you know, I've always enjoyed, you know, my conversations with Chunda ever since, like I said, I met him back last year when I went to Zuzulu, and I end up, you know, I'll always be a little biased, you know, small angel in Ion, now Nucleus, so want to put that caveat in before the show, but happy to have him. I'm happy to bring his insights. You know, we not only get into Nucleus, but we get into, like, his thoughts on, like, the current state of scaling, you know, his thoughts on, like, oh, like, 1559, like, now that we've seen it out in the wild, like, what are some reflections on that? So we really get into everything here. So before we get into the episode, make sure you go ahead, hit that bell button, subscribe. Let us know what you think in the comments. Give us a like. Go ahead, follow us on all of our socials on YouTube, Twitter, TikTok, Telegram, at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22.
You can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And let's get the flywheel spinning. All right, guys, welcome back to Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here with Capital K. And this time we welcome back for a third time to the show, Chunda McCain, the co-founder of Nucleus, formerly Ion, which is working on native yield, which is working on yield by default to chains and the masses alike. Chunda has and his protocol has done quite a bit of evolving since we last had him on, and, you know, wanted to bring him back to give us an update. So Chunda, thank you so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me. Always love being here. I remember the last time I was on, I think it was with Tarun.
It was with Tarun. You were my guest co-host with Tarun.
They were talking about restaking. That's good time.
It's all about restaking, Eigen. He requested to have Balloon on as the guest of the future, but I don't know if you can have a TEE on.
Hey, he'll try.
Yeah, he'll try. Yeah, exactly. But you know, for those who haven't watched the previous episodes, can you give us a bit of background, a bit of context, like, you know, who you are, how did you start Ion, what Ion was, and why did you decide to go the direction of Nucleus?
Yeah, 100%. So, for those of you who aren't familiar with me, my name's Chunda. I've been building the space for a little bit. Spent my time actually in issues, a smart contract engineer in the space. And then kind of expanded to do a little bit of everything and built focused on product. And we did mech design at, like, an earlier DeFi protocol from the folks who built Vary Capital back in the day. And then spent a little bit of time actually doing DeFi research at a venture fund. And it was actually while I was there, we ended up doing the Eigenlayer Series A, that I was inspired to build out Ion. And the kind of beginning of the journey of where we got to with Nucleus started with this idea that Eigenlayer and restaking, and keep in mind, this was Q3 2022 when I was, like, first introduced to that, the idea of restaking. The idea of Eigenlayer and the concept of restaking was really interesting to me because it really kind of personified, like, a turning point in being able to actually monetize and build financial infrastructure around, well, blockchain infrastructure. And although a lot of folks kind of dialed in and focused in on this concept of, you know, programmable security, this idea of decreasing the cost overhead of security and bootstrapping these programmable applications, The thing that actually really interested me was this idea of, oh, now users can actually have direct access to the financial upside of infrastructure by helping secure it. And to me, I was like, why isn't this one of the largest financial markets in crypto in general? And why isn't this a more widely popular type of market that people are realizing is specifically crypto native? And so the origination of Ion came from this idea of like, okay, what is one of the most basic building blocks required to actually financialize this concept of infrastructure? And that came in the concept of lending and borrowing secured by slashing instead of by traditional market pricing and things of that nature. And what we soon realized was that Ion was really, like we said, it was the fundamental first step, that building block for a bigger whole. And we didn't really see the entire picture at the time. But soon after, this was around by the end of 2023, we recognized that, wait, there's this bigger picture at hand where the current dynamic for how infrastructure interplays with users really is a bit broken. When we think about kind of what the user relationship with infrastructure is, if I'm a user and let's say I go, you know, bridge my assets to a roll up or an alternative network, I'm inheriting a whole bunch of third party infrastructure risk, right? Everyone has a story of, you know, a bridge getting hacked, or, you know, a chain halting because of a third party dependency. And then you accidentally get liquidated on that per protocol, or, you know, you have your positions locked somewhere and they have to revert the chain, right? And so it's like, you know, we have all these kind of systems where you're inheriting a lot of infrastructure risk. And not only do you not have direct upside in that infrastructure or really in the chain just by proxy of bringing that capital over sometimes, these infrastructure platforms actually extract value from the user. And it's called revenue, right? You know, that bridge fee, the DA cost overhead, everything, you know, you get the incremental product benefits. Sometimes orders are actually different, but really most of the time incremental, especially if it's a product that's being replicated or infrastructure that's being replicated. And so there's really no way for users to actually have upside and ownership of these ecosystems that they're being a part of. And so the question that we try to answer when it came to building Nucleus was, one of the core principles around crypto is this idea of decentralized and sovereign ownership, especially user owned things. And the core thing was, how do we enable users to then own a piece of these ecosystems and, you know, kind of figuratively like build equity in these ecosystems that they're a part of and they help make successful with their capital and actions?
Got it. I think another way you described it to me is you're financializing the risk that already exists in the infrastructure and allowing users to have the upside in that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we were able to get upside from taking on risk in a financial sense. Why don't we get that same dynamic from an infrastructure perspective?
Got it. And what are these risks that are being financialized? What are the basically quote-unquote products that Nucleus is offering here?
Yeah, so the kind of core premise of what Nucleus is enabling comes from this idea of yield by default. So what we're financializing is actually a few layers of the stack. So the concept of yield by default is effectively the concept of just being able to generate revenue or yield by moving your assets into a new ecosystem. Ecosystem, I also define as like a network. So you can think of it as like a new rollup or a new app chain, a new L1, things of that nature. So when you bring your assets over from, let's say, mainnet over to a Ethereum mainnet to a different L1 or a different L2 or app chain, you're able to generate a yield just by moving those assets over, right? And the way you do it is actually through a network-specific asset. And that network-specific asset, let's say we used a random network, let's use Arbitrum, for example. So we're chatting about Arbitrum before you got started. You bridge your ETH over to Arbitrum. You admit like a specific version of ETH for Arbitrum. And this asset would then represent a few layers of return. One is the underlying collateral that you deposited. So let's say if the kind of implementation supports things like STETH or LRTs, you're able to take that revenue and bring it with you. So you're not leaving it behind on mainnet. And the second thing is really risk minimized DeFi strategies. So we focus on what we call market risk agnostic. So that's no leverage, liquidation risk, no price risk, market neutral DeFi strategies. And then on top of that, infrastructure-based returns and infrastructure-based revenue, which means imagine you could actually get a share of the DA revenue, the oracles that power the Arbitrum ecosystem. Every little piece of infrastructure that makes the Arbitrum ecosystem tick, you could actually gain a portion of that income as a user.
Can we double click into that? The gaining the yield from every little infrastructure provider. Now, look at me. I am the extractor now. You know, that's the meme. So how is the user, like, how are these infrastructures on Arbitrum or any of these L2s are actually paying me for my Steth deposit into the Arbitrum ecosystem?
Yeah. The question you have to ask is, when you think about chain infrastructure, you have to think about how do they acquire customers, right? Like, what is the methodology in which they do? So traditionally, let's say I'm a DA layer. I'm a DA layer. My core customer is rollups. So I need to go, maybe L1's looking at case examples. So I need to go and find, you know, these rollups and convince them to integrate, right? And when I go and try to, you know, find these folks, a lot of, you know, rollup founders, so I'm being like really honest about the situation, don't really find too much of a differentiation with DA solutions at the bottom of the stack. And especially the consumer facing rollups, it kind of matters less. So the question is like, okay, what is your competitive advantage? How do you actually position yourself to build a relationship with that rollup and its users, right? And really the only viable way I believe forward is to actually build kind of a model in which you can share a portion of that revenue or that network upside with the user. And so what our system effectively allows us to do is there's kind of two levels that it can occur at. It can get really granular, or it can be really generalized. Users, when they bring their capital over into the system, they have these like specialized assets. So let's use Arbitrum as an example. So we can track all of the user capital in Arbitrum. And then what we do is we say to that DA layer, hey, we can index all of the user information, user data on Arbitrum, and the proportion, let's say the, you know, the DA layer makes $1 million of revenue that month or something, right? But we could say, hey, we saw that Arbitrum was about 50% of that demand for blockchain storage, right? So 50% of that revenue, or 50% of the fraction of the revenue that gets distributed to users, actually gets distributed to the holders of Arbitrum. And what we can do is actually bring it one level lower, and we can say, okay, let's look at all of the users and holders of Arbitrum, and they're using these assets in the Arbitrum ecosystem and doing different things with it. Which users actually consumed the most block space on Arbitrum? And then you can distribute incentives on the basis of that. And so it's this kind of concept of, hey, as infrastructure, I want to acquire as many users as possible. And really, what is the best way to do that is to reward users for in ownership for being able to provide that kind of core revenue source that is important to a piece of infrastructure. And on the back end, it's like, why does it have to be this new thing? So why can't it be, you know, just regular ETH on Arbitrum? Well, what we do is we actually create an underlying kind of connections between the user and the infrastructure by putting up that underlying capital in the vault instance to secure that infrastructure as well within the context of ABS. Is an ABS, correct? So the contingency is like any piece of infrastructure that can fit into the system has to be an ABS. But you know, we can help spin that up pretty quickly for folks if that's like of interest. And so what we can do is effectively enable any ABS to have a pipeline for customer acquisition in a way to directly incentivize users to leverage their infrastructure on the chains that they're deployed with versus, you know, just any infrastructure anywhere. And users get to have ownership by securing the ABS and also being a user of the ABS at the same time.
When you go ahead, Kent.
I just want to summarize this because I feel like this point is so like eloquent because it touches on every stakeholders in just the right areas. All right. So I feel like with the user, you are now capitalizing on, let's just call it lost revenue, because this whole time, you know, Dave and I have been suckers and just using these chains, using these infrastructure and just like, you know, paying all these fees to them. Now they're going to pay us back. So I'm very happy as a user. Now, as a infrastructure provider, you need to compete with like other, say, DA layers or other oracles or other anything. How do you kind of do that? And you basically create a platform for them to do user acquisition. And you're doing this in a very sustainable way because it's a rev share. It's not that they're just like, you know, printing out new tokens and giving out emissions. Maybe they could do that on top, not going to rule it out, but as long as that's also part of the element. But thirdly, you're also really helping the chains because the rollups themselves could also potentially be a bit external beneficiary of this, because if we know that this DA layer is paying a ton for this specific rollup, then the user may be more, has an affinity or an incentive to go over to this rollup versus another. So like the chain really likes this because it adds a whole new attractiveness, like a whole new dimension of attraction that they didn't have before. So I feel like this is a really, you know, comprehensive structure you kind of built there. Did I capture it correctly?
I think you 100% captured it correctly. And one of the things I actually really like about the system and the design of it is actually a second order externality, which I really appreciate when it comes to like traditional like business philosophies, which is what it does is it makes good infrastructure succeed larger and bad infrastructure fail quicker. Because what it does is for infrastructure that has a legitimate use that users really resonate in, can generate real revenue at scale, those pieces of infrastructure scale quickly and aggressively within this framework. And infrastructure that doesn't do that, well, it dies quicker because they're not able to extract as much value from users and capture as much value because they're going to be forced to give some of that back to users. So that's what I really like, because I know there's a lot of discontent in the ecosystem around like, why are we building more infrastructure? Why does it not feel like the average user gets the upside in this infrastructure? You know, it feels detached from the normal experience of a user kind of participating in these ecosystems. So this is the way that we can kind of change that dynamic and have users actually have a vested interest in the infrastructure that they're being a part of, because, you know, at the end of the day, they're building a ownership in it.
Yeah. And that's what blockchains are all about, you know, democratizing ease of access. And this just, you know, brings it more, that this brings it deeper with the infrastructure and brings it out to a larger, basically, base.
Yeah. That's the goal.
Yeah. So, you know, Chunda's Nucleus project is infrastructure, but different. Same, but different.
Exactly. You know? When you were saying before, rewarding users based on block space, it reminded me a bit of Fox on Fractal.
Yes.
That's the first thing that came to mind.
I think the idea of sequencer revenue kickbacks, I mean, the idea of like the Unichain one pager had the same idea. You stake Uni, you know, share the sequencer fees. That's kind of like the beginning. I think that conversation, you know, this concept has existed for a while. And that was like one of the other inspirations for the concept was like, hey, you know, this conversation has existed. One of the barriers to that is, you know, regulatory implications of taking the revenue of the core company that you're, you know, kind of operating in the product associated with that labs entity and sending that to people. That kind of takes a step around that and says, well, it's actually not your revenue that you're distributing, really. It's actually the commodification of these other different kind of payments that are happening from partners.
So you did take a look at the Unichain one pager. I'm curious what your thoughts are on yet another L2.
Yes, yet another L2. I chat with a lot of
it is your business, though.
So. It is your business. Yeah,
it is your business.
It is the business.
It's very funny. People now, there's like this inflection point. I've noticed on CT where like folks are, oh my gosh, don't we have too many L2s? And I'm like, 6 months ago, I was like, that. Like this has been the case for a long time. It's been a long time coming. I think a lot of L2 founders have been building kind of more quietly, and it's now all coming to light. So I have a core thesis about rollups and app chains and why you should build them and what will be successful in the long run. I have a bit of a controversial opinion that I don't believe generalized rollups will exist in the next 5 years, maybe even less.
I don't think that's controversial. I think that's becoming the norm.
But that's fantastic to hear.
Yeah.
People call that a controversial take here. Yeah, so it's.
I literally had a phone call with my friend at another infrastructure provider, and he said the exact same thing.
Oh, really?
Literally, okay, well, the I'm exact glad same you thing. With me.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah, all generalized, you know, L2s except for Arbitrum, of course, right? But yes, continue. Please continue.
Except for her. No, I hold no favorites. But with that being the case, the question is like, okay, what are the actual next rollups are going to be successful? What does it mean to be successful as a rollout if you cannot build a generalized state environment that's like an alternative to Ethereum? So the way I kind of see the role of rollups in the greater ecosystem is that rollups effectively are distribution for Ethereum's infrastructure. And the key word there is distribution.
Distribution.
Exactly. Your job is to connect real users with the concept and core infra that makes Ethereum Ethereum. And which means that at the end of the day, your responsibility is ownership of the user relationship. And that's why we've seen the growth of app chains and app-specific rollouts recently, right? Because if I'm owning the user relationship, why don't I own the block space as well? Why can't I not attach the block space as well, right? And every single large DeFi protocol of the old guard have done this. Major has plans to build a chain. Aave is building an app-specific L2. Uniswap with their app-specific L2.
Fraxis is the beginning of the year.
Yeah, Fraxis is the beginning of the year. Even Athena, a more modern chain, is doing this. All the other LRTs are doing it. Puffer is doing it. Swell is doing it.
Yeah.
Every single large protocol who is able to capture user mindshare wants to be able to own the block space that that mindshare sits on. And so these applications can own their distribution very well. So then the question is, okay, what about Movement Labs, the Scrolls of the world, these other pre-existing rollups that already exist that aren't applications? Well, to me, I think there's this other sector of rollups that can still exist in cohesion with app-specific rollups and app chains, which are ecosystem-specific rollups, right?
They're not ecosystem, they're ecosystem-specific.
Ecosystem-specific, yes. Mm-hmm. Where you need to build my philosophy, like how we should think about like ecosystem specific worlds is as nation states, right? When I go travel to a country, there's a reason I'm there, right? They're incentivizing a certain type of commerce. They're incentivizing a certain type of citizen, certain types of activities, right? And a certain type of public government infrastructure, right? Public goods, different types of schooling, health insurance systems, things of that nature. That is meant for their population. I believe that the role of ecosystem-specific role of founders should be to think about, hey, what kind of application vertical can I monopolize or try to own the distribution of, right? I think examples of this are roll-ups like Plume, right? Like an RWA-focused roll-up. There's other examples of this in the ecosystem as well, LRT5, right? And what does it mean for me to actually build public infrastructure that everyone in that ecosystem can use? So for, examples with like RWAs, it can be like, hey, I'm embedding the KYC system like at the core of the world. I know this is another role that's doing that as well, forgetting the name of. But there's public infrastructure that nearly every application, if I'm, an Ondo, if I'm Maple, if I'm whoever, I'm still going to want to go and use a role like this because, this is infrastructure I need anyway, right? So building those public goods, because then you can actually justify some kind of revenue share with the application. You can justify the sharing of that block space because you are providing them service. And I think when we look towards, the big incumbent rollups that are in the ecosystem currently, the biggest questions I always ask every single one of our clients that we work with is, what is the identity of your rollup? And what public goods are you planning on building or are going to build that will help enable that identity to flourish and make sure that that identity is differentiated from everyone else in the ecosystem?
Yeah, it's like we were saying at the beginning of the episode, for L1s, people don't build on Rust because it's Rust. People build on Solana.
Yeah, 100%.
Credit to Zon. credit to Zahn over Zahn
for the great quote.
Yeah. Do you feel early in the show you said like, oh, with what you're building, we're going to see like different infrastructure, like what succeeds and what fails faster. I feel like this can be provided, like this could be provided with the same with rollups, because if you're putting yourself as an option, you see like what users are actually going to be there and what users aren't going to be there.
I totally agree. Rollups will also die quicker and succeed larger and faster. And yeah. I think the biggest thing is, well, you have to have an impetus to care and focus a lot more on the user. And really curating that user experience, where I think there's, generally a lot of discontent about the user plight being kind of put to the backseat in the current day.
Yeah.
Okay. And actually, Jinda, one last question, and then I promise we're going to get down into the brass tacks of the Nucleus product, which is also super sick. All right. So I watched one of your talks here, and you mentioned that the ABSs are kind of the bottlenecks kind of in the system, in a sense that after a certain point where they no longer want to spend on security because they don't want to dilute the yield, right? They want to cap, like, hey, I only need this much security. So now there's going to be cap introduced. So how do you kind of fit that? Like, hey, I'm going to grow at the speed I need to grow versus, you know, what you were saying, how good infrastructure is just going to grow super aggressively.
Right? Yeah, that's a really good question. So the actually original inspiration, so Nucleus is a combination of a whole bunch of ideas and thoughts I've had over the past like 2 years. Mm-hmm. And the actual original inspiration for the infrastructure monetization solution was to solve a really large problem around restaking platforms that's a little bit understated. You know, some people chat about this, but it's not as widely, I think, delved into in detail, which is the economic model of restaking inherently is a little bit broken of shared security, because you get the situation where if I share security with almost every application in the ecosystem, right? And just as a baseline, right? Security is not a hot commodity. Not everyone needs it at large scale. In fact, most don't. So you already have this commodity that's in low demand generally, right? There's a need for some of it. There's an essential need, but not at scale. And so this commodity has low demand. And now low demand plus everyone can share the cost of the commodity, which already doesn't have high demand. And then everyone shares the cost and also pays on the same platform to the same person, which means basically I have the impetus to pay just as little as the next guy, or less than the next guy, so that way the next guy can cover my costs for me to the same user. And then that person is thinking the same thing about everyone else in the system, which means everyone just has an incentive to pay as little as possible, right? And basically pay nothing if they can. And if, other protocols want to subsidize that cost, or like are inadvertently doing that, well, then they're just going to sit back and not pay anything and allow other protocols to subsidize costs, right? And so the problem with that is kind of stems out the core thing that I mentioned initially, which was security is a commodity with generally low demand at scale. So the question I was trying to answer is, how do you integrate a commodity that has high demand no matter what scale you're at? And that one commodity is users. In fact, it's a commodity that is so core to the principle of business. Just let's step outside of ABS, let's step outside of crypto. It's so core to the principles of businesses in general that we have a term for it. It's called a customer acquisition cost, right? And what we're effectively doing within this concept of Nucleus is not only enabling people to purchase security within restaking platforms, but actually truly kind of like extending this AWS vision, because AWS isn't just purchasing compute. You purchase a bunch of other things as well. And so we're kind of adding something to the list. You now can purchase access to distribution, right? And that is something where you go to any infrastructure provider and you say, hey, I can enable you to access distribution. That's a game changer for them.
Yeah. Okay. I see. Now that it's not a a cost, and it still is a cost, but it now went from a pure cost center to a cost of revenue, which is what
exactly. Yeah. And now revenue can scale in theory infinitely. So the goal now is your cost in theory scale infinitely, which means again, at the end of the day, where's all that cost going to? It's going back to users and our hits.
Speaking of scaling Ethereum, there's been this debate going on right now between, is the roll-up centric roadmap still the path? I think everybody agrees it's the path we want to take, but should we, I think the debate is like, should we ignore the L1 completely or actually make some tweaks and improvements to the L1? I'm curious where you stand on scaling the L1 and where you're at the current state of the roll-up centric roadmap. Because I feel like part of it is not just scaling the L1 and L2. What we were talking about earlier about national identity, I feel like Ethereum is having a bit of a, I wouldn't say crisis, but a little bit of a reflection period of its national identity. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, my first kind of foundation of how I think about this question is Ethereum was kind of built as an open generalized platform. And when Ethereum was first built, the idea of, we need to force all value accrual to aggregate at the L1 layer from all of the demand for state in Ethereum was not a thing. 1559 and the gas burn was not a thing when Ethereum was built, right?
Yeah.
That was conceptualized way later into the future. And then the modular roll-up-centric roadmap, although it was kind of pushed at the beginning, it really didn't come into form until more recent history. And so I think the goal of Ethereum has always been to be the world computer, the centralized kind of consensus-based layer for centralized applications. And I think that should always be the impetus and the core focus when it comes to development and focuses there. Now, I do think that it would be nice for Ethereum to accrue more value. I think current solutions like the conceptualization of base rollups and things of that nature really ask too much of a trade-off for the builder who can basically step out of that as an alternative. And I think constraining builders into basically forcibly picking the base infrastructure is not really the best system, in my opinion. I think the thing we should be doing is kind of stepping outside of the box to think about new and more novel ways of doing this. For example, this entire system that Nucleus is built on and this concept of restaking and you building infrastructure on top of Ethereum and then allowing Ethereum to be a form of distribution for you. Why can't we find a way to enshrine maybe a more risk minimized implementation of this that has less technical surface area, risk minimized from a technical implementation standpoint, less surface area for risk from an implementation standpoint using the same concepts, right? Why don't we find a methodology where, there's some kind of interplay between a demand for core Ethereum L1 block space and then a demand for L2 block space, and there's kind of interplay between those two. I think there are kind of two different camps in this space. I think there's the camp of the originating kind of Ethereum contributors and kind of developers who look at the long-term state of Ethereum and look at this discussion and says, it doesn't even matter. It's not even going to be relevant in 10 years, right? If Ethereum is a ZK solid state layer and the concept of block space demand and how exactly rollups even work and Ethereum can scale nearly infinitely is the future, the situation of how exactly the economics works is going to change anyway, right? There's the camp of folks who are looking at kind of the short term, medium term here. And I think realistically, whatever we're going to build is going to be kind of a band-aid for the end state that we want to reach with Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And I think when you people talk a lot about investing in Ether as an asset because it all surrounds Ether as an asset and the value proposition of Ether as an asset. And to me, I think there's this core store of value that Ether has as an asset with respect to the technological innovation that is behind Ethereum, the chain. And I think there's a really strong dichotomy that is created between like Bitcoin and Ethereum, and like neither, like Bitcoin has to be the only store of value. Like no one argues that silver can't be a store of value because gold is a better one, right? Or that, you know, silver has like this hybrid relationship between utility, because it is used in a lot of things, but it's not really the main thing that backs it up. Silver, it's really just,
you could argue it's used in more things.
Yeah, you could argue it's definitely used in more things. And then also you say that, like, but no one really looks at silver as also like, oh, well, because it's gold is better store of value, the same doesn't have actually any store of value properties. There's this weird dichotomy that people like to paint. And I think that really, like, when you look at, again, the 10-year future, Ethereum or Ether is an asset, is effectively a store of value because of the technology that backs it. It can exist in a hybrid relationship with Bitcoin because that idea of a store of value is slightly different, because the relationship between Bitcoin and value and Ether and value is a bit different. And then we should be thinking about we want to bring capital flows back to Ether, the asset, we should be thinking a little bit out of the box and a little bit more in that longer time scale, because, you know, in the short term, I don't believe there's an existential risk to Ethereum if we deprioritize the value flows back to the asset, because again, at the beginning of Ethereum's existence, that has been a priority.
Got it.
Nice. Kit, Dave, you want to summarize that for the people?
Or do you want to summarize that?
No,
I'm still marinating. So, if I had to summarize it in my own words, I'd say, yes, keep up with this Roll-Up-centric roadmap. It may be like a little bit bumpy right now, but keep the destination in mind.
Yeah, and it's like, I think, if I were to say my own words, the thing would be like, the origination of the Ether's value as an asset and what Ethereum was meant to be, was that centered around like capital flows back to Ethereum, either the asset or Ethereum, right? This has been a kind of like short to medium term sentiment since 1559, in my opinion.
Yeah, I took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say like 1559 deviated from that course. That was basically Ethereum peeps saying like, we want to be more like Bitcoin.
Yeah, it was like, how can we be, well, actually it was like, how can we be different from Bitcoin? And how can we justify Ether flipping Bitcoin? I think that should have never been the conversation. So of course, there's a lot of money invested interest in making that be the case.
Of course.
Realistically, right. I think from a philosophy.
Do you think 1559 was the proper move? Or do you think, you know, Ethereum would have been better off without 1559?
That's actually a really good question.
Yeah. We've seen it over the past few years.
The one thing I appreciate about Ethereum and Ethereum development in general is the willingness to experiment within very like closed, like confined circles. I think it's okay to look back on 1559 and be like, hey, it was a good attempt. We tried something new. It was a very interesting idea. Don't think it was necessary or like maybe I'd say beneficial for the narrative around Ethereum. I think if people would argue on that topic, 100% of people think 1559 was definitely needed. But I think it's okay to look back and say, maybe this wasn't the best upgrade. Maybe we never needed it. And I think that's part of the allure to Ethereum.
Yeah, especially about the focus on everything being a meme.
Yeah, I don't think, yeah, narratives are obviously simple. Right.
Yeah.
I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe everything needs to have a narrative. Again.
What do you mean not everything needs to have a narrative?
What's the narrative around silver?
Right. It's been around for thousands of years.
Is that really the only narrative behind silver? I'm sure people
have a bunch of narratives. As someone that like bought and sold silver on eBay when he was in high school, I looked into this deeply. And the narrative around it, it's like, oh, it's like, you know, it's like gold, but cheaper, and you can afford it, and you can afford like large portions of it. Oh, it's used in cell phones, like this and that. Look at all the utility of it. Like, oh, like blah, blah, blah.
They all sound like very interesting parallels, don't they?
It's literally the same thing. It's all a meme. It's all.
Yeah, and like, hey, there's no one. It doesn't need to be one thing, really, that unifies. Yeah. I understand it's great for everyone's bags if that's the case.
Yeah.
My favorite part about silver was how the market was cornered in the 80s by these two twin brothers. And they they ran it up to like, I don't know, like 40 or 80 bucks. Then it completely collapsed. It collapsed to like $80 to $4. I wish I got I don't remember the name of those twin brothers. But then like it's been steadily grinding up. And I remember around like 2008 to 2010, that's when it jumped from like $9 to like $30. And I was like, oh shit. Because it was like, you know, post-recession, everybody like was like hoarding gold, hoarding silver. I'm not sure how it's doing now. I'm sure it's doing well because gold has been on a tear. It's been interesting to see gold kind of diverge from Bitcoin. It's like when things get like a little bit shaky in the world, it's gold that's going up, and Bitcoin is more correlated with the stock market than it is gold, even though it's like, oh, digital gold, quote unquote.
Yeah. Actually, I'm looking at the silver futures right now. They hit an all-time low in 2020 because of the inflation associated with the market exploding post-2020. But it's now back up to the highs in 2012.
Oh, so it's almost at like $30?
It's at 30. It's past 30. It's 31. 31.4.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Okay, I think we need to rename DeFi Dave into Precious Metal David.
Silver Dave. No, I was buying and selling silver on eBay in high school. I was there was actually a website dedicated to like the price of gold and silver and precious metals specifically on eBay.
On eBay, right? That's so interesting. I didn't know. There's like this one of those wafer companies, man.
It's like been around, but it has definitely has its base of like users and like things that are being sold. But yeah, I haven't been in the silver flipping game in like 15 years. So I can't speak much of it now, but it was a fun experience in high school.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay. All right, boys. I think it's time to bring it back into the center and enter the nucleus, right?
Bring it back to the nucleus.
Ah, yeah. I like that.
You like what I did there? Okay. So, there are these vaults in the nucleus's architecture, right? And now as a user, let me walk you through this little user journey. Is I'm going to bring my Steth into the nucleus, or wrap Steth into the nucleus's app on mainnet. I then deposit my wrap Steth into one of these vaults, all right? And my end destination is to go onto Arbitrum, right? Take that wrap Steth onto Arbitrum. Could you walk me through what happens the moment after I deposit that wrap Steth, and then also when I want to come home back onto the mainnet?
Yeah, good question. So I will kind of clarify a little bit that just so you folks who are listening are aware, Nucleus isn't kind of one central hub for, and the liquidity isn't kind of stored in one place and it's shared between every rollup and app. It's not really our focus. What we do is we create these chain specific or network specific, to be more precise, and then asset specific within the network falls. So you will get an Arbitrum ETH, and you might get Scroll USD, and you might get an Optimism BTC, right? So it's a very specific network asset relationship, and all of these things are set. But yeah, let's talk about what happens in the background when you enter into one of these assets. So we use the Arbitrum example. So you go, there's two places you can go usually. Usually there's an interface hosted by us. We always host an interface of every single one of our networks and implementations that we do. And then usually the network also hosts their own interface, where you can go to that network itself, go to the bridge interface, and find either our asset or, you know, some part of the UI that allows you to bring your assets over directly from there. So we make this process, our philosophy makes process as simple as possible, and we can bring it to as many people as possible. So let's say you go and we say, all right, we see that this implementation or this chain for Arbitrum ETH accepts WrapSync ETH and regular ETH. Okay, cool. So we go in, and once that asset is deposited, there's what we call sister deployments, where there's actually two instances of two contracts that can custody your capital, one on mainnet and one in the destination state environment. And they both communicate with each other. We use cross-chain interop service providers to do this. These two instances communicate with each other to create a core kind of accounting rate that maps all of the collateral underlying the asset. So what happens is your money goes into that vault instance, gets stored on mainnet or in the destination chain. What this also enables, actually, too, which is a nice feature, is people can deposit capital on the L2 itself. So it's cool. And then automatically, your asset is then brought over to that destination state environment. It's a regular ERC-20 minted. And then internally, there's this accounting exchange rate that updates every so often, that updates the value of your asset to track the yield that you're generating. Simple as that.
Got it. And then how are these yield kind of generating so that I keep getting an incremental increase or decrease in my shares value of the vault?
Yeah. So there's a couple layers to where you can actually source revenue. The first layer, the absolute bottom, is the type of asset that you're depositing. So if you deposit, an LST, an LRT, Bitcoin LST, yield bearing stablecoin, whatever, those revenues are not left on mainnet. They're not taken away by us or anything. They're actually transferred and brought with you into that destination environment. So you're bringing that ETH, that staked ETH revenue with you. So that's going to get attached on. And then on top of that, we're able to actually deploy the underlying cloud onto whitelisted public DeFi strategies that are what we call market risk agnostic. I'll go into what that means real quick. Market risk agnosticity is basically the idea of not exposing users to the traditional type of risk return relationship that's associated with DeFi yields. So for example, if I LP into an ETH USDC LP pool, I can generate APY on that. Am I even appreciating value? But I'm taking on market risk because these two assets are correlated with each other, right? If I go take out a loan on Aave, or like leverage loop on Aave, and I'm exposed to like a price oracle, if some market pricing happens where those assets fall in value, I could get liquidated. Even if I'm just lending Aave, I could get liquidated, right? So we try to stay away from those types of things and try to focus on sources of DeFi yield that are isolated to only infrastructure-based risks, meaning like smart contract or things like Slash and other things. So the protocol that we built previously, Ion Protocol, which was a lending platform focused on underwriting slashing risk and slashing risk only, that is a great example of kind of this type of infrastructure risk only type revenue sources. So we got this DeFi strategy. So you're coming in, you're bringing in the revenue from the asset, bringing in these like really risk minimized market risk agnostic DeFi strategies. And then on top of that, you have the last and final step, which is that infrastructure based yield. And that infrastructure-based revenue is, then coming from those pieces of infrastructure that are ADSs in that destination ecosystem metric part.
Got it. And it sounds like I'm going to use the staked ETH as like the asset here just to make it easier, right? It has a yield-bearing asset, and I'm earning that. So I'm earning the Steth native yield. Then I'm also earning the DeFi yields that comes with using Steth in DeFi, and particularly in these market agnostic strategies that you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then lastly is now this infrastructure revenue piece that I get from what we spent the first 30 minutes of the podcast talking about, right? I'm getting rewarded for all this. So my Steth is being really ultra productive right here. It's like it's super caffeinated, and it's like it's doing like six people's job right now.
Exactly. The idea is to maximize the value of your liquidity for you, the user, and to do so without inheriting most of the risks that you would actually inherit if you deploy those assets at DeFi, and really focusing on siloing as much as possible into infrastructure-oriented risks. Okay. Now, I will caveat slightly that when you deal with stable type implementations, this implicitly stables inherit market risk because they're stable coins.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a little bit of a difficulty segmenting that on stablecoin implementations because of any overhang stablecoin inherits like treasury bond risk. So is that what you can do about that? But yeah, for each and every coin, the philosophy is to completely segment those.
Got it. And then, sorry, one last question about the infrastructure layer because of the AVSs that are being used. Like, do I, as a depositor, get to go through like a menu and be like, I want this, I don't want this, I want this, I don't want this? Or do you just kind of basket them all together? And, you know, how are risk kind of allocated
so
there?
So we do basket it all together, but it's on a network right now basis. So the core philosophy is that you should not be inheriting more risk that you're than you're internalizing by bringing your assets over to the network. So bringing my assets over to a network that uses Eigenvalue, I'm implicitly inheriting some of the risk, right? And of the nodes and the node behavior. Now, is it like completely one-to-one with like restaking that 100%? But that's a general principle. And so the idea is, okay, I'm only inheriting the infrastructure risk and the slashing risk of the pieces of infrastructure that that network is using. Now, of course, you can then if you find a way to restake into other asset or other infrastructure, that's a whole other thing. But yeah, that's the core idea.
Gotcha. Understood. And Dave, go ahead. You had a question?
Yeah. I'm curious if you have any numbers of how much additional yield these yield strategies bring on top of, you know, something like APX ETH or Stacked.
Yeah. So imagine you're bringing in, like APX ETH. So imagine you're bringing in APX ETH, right? So you're high yielding LST market, I believe, right now. I think it's around 7% right now. So you're yielding 7% on the base assets. If you're doing risk minimized strategy, I won't purport to say exactly what these yields are, but you know, if ULP or let's say you're lending on ION, and people are kind of like looping assets and things of that nature, you might be able to generate a few extra percentage points on that. You can take a look at what those percents are right now. It's like 4 or 5%. And then imagine on top of that, infrastructure revenue. And this one's the really hard one to price because it just kind of depends on how the market dynamics work with infrastructure. Mm-hmm. If it's actually pure revenue, the yields will be generally lower. If they're, you know, in a growth phase and trying to acquire customers and they're showing out like more incentives, then it could be larger. So the way I look at it, I think a really good baseline to look at for like long-term cash flows for infrastructure, that's really important. I would say look at like bridging yield, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there is, I think, over $100 million to $250 million of bridging volume a day in the crypto ecosystem right now in this market. Imagine what that is in a bull market, right? And so that's a lot of revenue every day being captured by bridges. Imagine you just could get a portion of that, right? And I know, you know, if you look at bridging, I think LPs into bridges and then like solvers who participate in Tempest bridges usually net between like another 5 to 20%, depending on the markets, what kind of assets the market making, things of that nature. So that's just, and again, that's just one piece of infrastructure.
I'm thinking of a scenario because you hear about these bridges, for example, XDAI or like that to Gnosis. They put their DAI in SDAI to gain yield. But I guess with something like Nucleus, not only can like they do that, but they can also bring it for this additional yield, you know, whether it's to help with bridging itself. That seems kind of like meta. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's basically allowing, you can use the underlying capital to help like fill orders on the bridges itself and for the network itself. It's kind of this cool thing where you kind of get access to, fast finality or like fast bridging by proxy, just because you have more liquidity in the bridge for your chain. Okay, cool. There's a lot of really interesting second order effects there that we can get into, but the core idea is, a lot of these pieces of infrastructure actually also require liquidity and capital. And so why not use the user capital to do it? Since a lot of times here are the rest of those systems anyway.
Yeah. Is this the cross-chain intents that you were saying in the docs?
Yeah, this is the cross-chain intents. It's a really good, I really like using this baseline example because there's a lot of hyperglobe that's around those yields and like that volume and that data. And it's one of those kind of core tested use cases that has a lot of revenue. And also, it's just not being captured by users. And I just can take it from you, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Now. Give it back to the people. Yeah. And yeah. That this yield is on top of all the degenerate behavior that I'm going to be, you know, doing on the N network as well, too. Right.
Exactly. And, so this is just the first step. This is the first step of entering into any ecosystem where you have not touched DeFi. You have not inherited any type of market risk. You have not inherited any type of smart contract risk in that ecosystem yet. It is just the act of entering to the ecosystem, you get access to this. This is why we call it yield by default. Just by default, by coming to that ecosystem, you gain access to it. And then once you're in that ecosystem, go use Zasset and go use Zasset and a DEX. Go use it for payments for an NFT platform.
Yeah.
Go use it to go stake and play a game, right? The opportunities are endless. Yeah. And one of the actually secondary effects I really enjoy is the ability to experiment a lot on application business models with the concept of default yield. Like imagine a game where, or let's just go like down the deep end. Let's say, imagine you have a casino with zero edge, right? And people just are required to stake their capital into the casino and play in that realm for a fixed amount of time. And the casino just takes the yield and says, hey, we won't take any edge on these games. Go ahead and go play with other folks. Go ahead and play these games that we have, right? It's a really interesting concept. And, you know, you can replicate these types of things with DeFi as well. Perps with subsidized funding rates. You can imagine NFT platforms that have rebates if you use certain these assets, or like you can stake to mint instead of actually having to purchase things up front. A whole bunch of different opportunities here.
Dude, like the cost of capital for any action on chain has just been drastically subsidized by you guys, you know, for anything that happens on this network. Now, let's say I did two assets. Let's say I did a stablecoin and Steph. Right? Does it go in the same vault, or are there different vaults for every single asset for every single network?
Different vaults, every asset, every network. So let's say let's keep with the constant of Arbitrum. You might have like ARBIF. You will have you could have an ARBUTC, you could have an ARBUSD, right? And those are completely siloed. They do not inherit or share any risk. Those assets do not ever touch each other. And those assets are completely separate. And then an Arbitrum ETH would be different than like an Oculus ETH, right?
Yeah, right. And because the AVSs would be different and everything else. And
exactly.
Are stable coins able to tap into that AVS market? Like, could you be securitized by
dollars?
Yeah,
you can secure the stables. Right? It's value. Well. Yeah. There's actually protocols that are based out of, or that build basically like a stable coin based through staking, like purely. I think there's like a stable coin LRT out there. Yeah.
Got it. I think that's just called insurance, right? laughter. Okay. All right. So let's Dave, you know, I'll hand it off to you in a second, but just let me wrap off here with the no laughing matter. And I'm going to give the credit over to the boys over at FX Protocol and Aladdin DAO. Like, when bad things happen, okay, let's walk through this.
How does it happen?
Nucleus?
Yes. Good question. So a couple of parts of the stack that you want to be concerned about as a user and pay a lot of attention to. One is and I love that this becomes a thing, the infrastructure in the ecosystem that you're participating in. For the first time, I think, you know, a lot of us have, you know, everyone has that story of, again, like losing my Unibridge, losing my ecosystem, third-party chain home. Now you actually have it in front of your face, like, hey, these are the things that are securing this ecosystem. You should pay attention to what these things are and, you know, make a choice on whether or not you're going to partake in this ecosystem because of the things that are there. And that, I think, is actually a feature, not a bug, where people will actually start to take a look at that. And I encourage people to. The other thing that I think people should really pay attention to is what type of assets are backing all of these different implementations? What types of collateral are accepted? We are not an LST issuer. We're not an LRT issuer. We're not a stablecoin issuer. We're not a Bitcoin LST issuer. We don't issue any of these assets. That's not really our core primary focus. But which is fantastic because it means we can help the growth of a lot of these really interesting asset issuers who are building these really great products. The downside is we're not the ones that are kind of core responsible for the internalization of the risk of all of these assets. It's going to be the users and the users' relationship with these asset issuers that are going to be very important. And so it also makes users be really conscientious about the asset issuers that they're taking part of, because if, you know, we will always have guardrails and risk mitigants around asset issuers getting hacked or exploited. But if a key leak happens with an LST and that ETH leaves those validators, it's not much we can do about it. Right. So things like that, also in, you know, the user inherits the risk of.
Got it. And just last follow up on my end is, you know, in the example that we talked before this call, where, you know, with that staked ETH that I put into Nucleus and then I brought it over onto ARP ETH. Now on ARP ETH, I took a collateral position against it. And then now my collateral ARP ETH actually gets the underlying ETH that I, the STETH that I initially put into the Nucleus protocol gets slashed. Like, is that value slash then transmitted all the way up into the Arbitrum network in this specific protocol that, hey, this person's collateral is no longer worth one ETH, is actually 0.95 ETH now because they got slashed at the Nucleus level. Like, is that communicated through and everything is wrapped?
That is communicated through. So if what happens is there's the like a core accounting exchange rate that tracks the value of the underlying collateral, null positions, with the asset that's existing in that state environment, right? So if it notices that, hey, all of the underlying collateral is, you know, so it got slashed or, you know, fell in value, like it like fell in value via principal, I mean, you know, hack up and it now slashed, just like these like infrastructure failures, then that gets communicated all the way to the top layer. The important thing, though, is nothing you do at the top layer affects the base layer. So if you're, you know, holding your RV, then you're going 50x long on purse, right? And you get liquidated. That's not going to affect anyone or anything down the stack, right?
Gotcha.
But infrastructure failures will communicate all up the stack.
Gotcha. Okay, right. Cool. Thanks, man.
I'm curious about how withdrawals work in the Nucleus system. Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah, 100%. So what we try to do, we always try to optimize for UX as much as we can. So we actually use what we call solver-based withdrawals. I can define what a solver is in like loose terms. Effectively, it's an entity or group of entities that basically manage order routing for users. And try to optimize like execution pathing for users. So if you ever have used the gas to swap feature on, applications like Uniswap and Matcha, those are solvers. Yes, those are solvers in the back end, filling those orders. I use Matcha, so that's great.
Yeah.
Great product. Love the UX. Shout out Matcha. So what we do is we actually use a similar framework for withdrawals. We will allow users to withdraw into nearly any asset within reason. And the ability to do that will be via automating the order routing for users and, you know, being able to fill those orders. The nice thing about solver-based withdrawals as well is it allows us to also fill orders quicker than if you initially deposited into the application, did all the like, kind of strategies it back. So imagine you restaked your capital, right? And you have that like 7-day time long, 14-day window. Normally you wouldn't be able to address this out for like 1-2 weeks, right? We might be able to find a counterparty that's willing to take on that risk and we just fill you your order ahead of time. We might be able to use some capital on another pool, maybe another pool that allows some yield to fill that order, right? So you actually get this cool thing where you can like credit and debit accounts between different state environments to actually help fill orders, which is, gets really interesting as a source of yield. So you can effectively allow users like faster withdrawals for some kind of cost overhead, cost of trade-off, or you can go just do full withdrawals at low cost or zero cost, right? So that's effectively how withdrawals work. You can think of it as like on Venmo. If you want, it in your bank account instantaneously. Yeah, you got to pay the 1%.
You got to pay up.
Yeah. But if you're willing to wait to 3 to 5 days, you'll get it.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Got it. I have one more question before we wrap up. So I like to call these like infrastructure vaults, and there are other infrastructure vaults out there. There's like Veda, there's Decent. I love how like Veda, like which you guys actually forked, it was called the Boring Vault. And I'm just like, that's such a funny name.
Yeah, it's a cool idea.
Boring Vault, it's anything other than boring. I'm curious, like, how does Nucleus view yield compared to these like other players in the market? And like, what are some differences?
Yeah. So actually, the difference between us and other yield protocols, there's a lot more in the ecosystem. You know, Yearn has existed for a very, very long time. And Zhyme and Shell and Zen folks, you know, have existed for a while, right? The way we kind of look at vaults in general is we don't actually think of ourselves purely as kind of a vault platform, because there's a lot of other moving parts here around the infrastructure monetization and a whole bunch of stuff that like we had to build out for that. The cross-chain interop, there's a whole bunch of stuff like associated with that we had to build out. And so the vault is just kind of like the base custody layer. And our philosophy was like, how do we diminish fragmentation, build with a growing gold standard, and kind of maximize and ensure, you know, as much security as possible. And it's like, let's use something that's being used in the ecosystem so far. The way we kind of look at our positioning is we're very, very kind of narrow focused. It's about this idea of being able to enable users to generate yield by default in chains, and then to change this dynamic of the infrastructure user relationship. You won't really see us building, you know, infrastructure on top or like yield models on top applications as well. We'll probably actually work with some of these people. You know, we've actually already had conversations with some other vault providers about, hey, we want to create like one-click options for you to deploy these network assets in DeFi in these destination state environments. Not really our thing. Let's bring some of these other vault companies and providers into it and kind of like share the where the growth can go. So there are things like that, you know, we kind of outsource, and we really focus on kind of the core principles of changing the dynamics around the infrastructure, user infrastructure relationship, and focusing on this idea of like yield by default at the network level. And there's a lot of other cool features that we're filling out. Things
Can
like
you give any hints into this roadmap, but other features? A treat for the people that have stayed the whole podcast.
Yeah, I would say fun things around the way you can pay gas. Hints there.
Pay master.
No more comments there. and then some other fun things are around I would say extending the use cases for consumers and what you can do outside of crypto with your holdings. So so I'd say like those are two things that are kind of like top of mind for us. And then also ETH, Bitcoin and stablecoin /USD aren't the only assets that exist. And there's, what if we could build a new way for value to flow towards, well, the assets that define these ecosystems.
AVS backed by meme coins. Let's go.
Yeah. So SPX a couple things there. Yeah,
the stock market both yield.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah. We'll leave it at that. And for users, for listeners to marinate on. Chunda, before we go, we always ask this question to guests. And it is, who would you recommend as a guest? Who do you want to see on Flywheel next?
That's a good question. Oh my gosh, I always forget to. I've been on this like three times. I don't have some on my head yet. I can't believe I've done this. I would say, let me think. Who have you guys not had on?
A lot of people.
Yeah, I know. It's so much more difficult now than it was back then. Because I'm like, God, it's so hard. There's so many people. I'll shout out some early builders that I haven't seen on. Oh, you should bring on, he's one of our partners, Vishwa from Anera. He's building a lot of Anera, A-N-E-R-A. He's building a lot of really cool solver infrastructure and solver liquidity infrastructure that's really interesting, changing up the way that a lot of kind of liquidity provisioning works behind the scenes with things like tokens and things of that nature. Really interesting guy, knows a lot about that part of the ecosystem and has some really unique insights that I think would be really cool to bring to your viewers. Also, it's a part of the sector I don't think I really see talked about as much on Flylo.
Yeah, write that one down, Vishnu.
Yeah, very excited. Yeah. I know nothing about that sector, so I'm definitely keen.
Yeah. Shout out to Vishnu. Hope you're on this soon.
Alrighty.
Shunda, thank you so much for coming on. We hope to see you soon.
Thank you guys, as always.
All right. Welcome to the Post Game Show. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here with Capital K. We are wrapping up an episode with Shunda of Nucleus, formerly Ion, and Kit. You were really excited for this one, especially with your new role at Arbitrum. I feel like you have a lot more insights and perspectives to bring to the table here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, being at an ecosystem, particularly I'm with the off-chain lab side, I still kind of see like what's happening in the ARP ecosystem. And I feel like a product like what Tunda is building just like unlocks a whole new dimension just for like all the users and obviously the info provider and obviously the chain itself too. So I'm very excited to see him come on. And more particularly, I feel that, you know, what Tunda is building is going to be a capital P primitive, but in like the most, like actually all caps primitive, not just capital P, because this becomes the base layer of the base layers. And it truly unlocked like this whole new, it reduces the cost of capital for everybody in the game. Like I was saying, like even more so, right?
Yeah. Now it's based, like,
yeah.
It's basically
like a casino could be free.
Yeah. I mean, that's what he called like a no edge casino where like the yield can be distributed to users. And what he's basically doing is a crypto native way to financialize the risk that already exists in blockchains and bring that value to the users themselves. That's what Nucleus is, which is pretty cool. Yeah. This is pretty cool. This is like the types of infrastructure and applications and products that we should be building. And, you know, been a fan of Tunda since I met him at Zuzulu. So definitely wanted to have him on with the update.
And just to clarify, Dave, I don't think Nucleus is a rebrand of Ion. I think it's built by the same
team. Evolution. Ion could have been a project of Nucleus, and then they basically chunked up a level and said, like, wait, like, what other yield strategies are out there? What other ways can we financialize the risk that exists at the infrastructure layer?
Yep, correct. It's just another product suite. So another I think just to clarify there for the folks. But I definitely feel like I missed the chance to speak with Tunda last year during KBW. So now I got a chance to actually fully connect with him.
Redemption
arc. And I think we had a great time. We asked some hard questions. You know, I didn't pull back. And he had really solid answers for that, right?
Yeah.
So I appreciate his honesty in like seeing things holistically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure we'll have him on again in the future. And when we do, you know what to do if you want to catch that. Hit that bell button. Go ahead, subscribe. Leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Give us a like. Follow us on all of our socials on YouTube, Twitter, TikTok, Telegram, at Flybo DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter, at DeFiDave22.
You can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And we'll see you next week. Peace. Everything said in this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not in investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.